Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. I have one more old-timey one for you. Okay, I've kind of gotten into them and they kind of sort of seamlessly bled into each other, but it's a fascinating one. It could have also been considered another crime of the century or a crime amongst rag-to-riches, royals, and beyond, and it involves a lady murderer or a femme fatale so infamous, so scandalous, so seductive that she seduced aristocrats, princes, and businessmen from all over the world, and her rags-to-riches story would become one that was embedded in the DNA of history. Sources for this episode are Wikipedia, two parts on a podcast called Solved Murders, which is very good, a Medium article by Sean Elder, and a Lost in History article by Paul Andrews. And I believe he also has a podcast. I did not listen to that, but I read his article. So let's get into it, Greg.
And a little audio note, my apologies for the reverb in the room. We're recording in our new living room of our new house. First podcast recorded in the new house.
This is great news.
Because both my parents are here, and it'd be impossible to get them both to be quiet for 30 minutes straight.
For in our 3 other seconds house. Straight. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't even want to try it. But it gave us the opportunity to record our first podcast in our new house.
Yeah, it did us a favor. Yeah, Greg's mom came here completely unannounced. Like, I thought it was a joke.
I thought it was a week early April Fool's joke.
Because she hasn't been here a full week, so like we wouldn't have mentioned this on the last podcast, right?
Nope, exactly. No, it happened.
Yeah, yeah. But I basically almost had a panic attack finding out that I was like, she's not. When Greg came in as I was finishing up like writing last week's episode. And he came in the room and he's like, my mom's coming, by the way. I don't want to upset you. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I just figured it was like in a couple weeks or something. I didn't quite understand until I saw his dad shuffling around, like kind of like a little panicked himself. And then I overheard him on the phone and I was like, wait, is she coming today? Like,
so my mom just calls my dad and is like, I'm at the Denver airport. She was visiting my aunt and she had a layover in Denver, but then I guess buddied up with a stewardess and was like, do I have to go on the next flight? And the lady even told her how to get her money back and she made her decision. She was just like, I'm coming to the ranch, which is totally fine and awesome.
It's been great to have her.
But like, shocking that like, I mean, I got a guy I'm hiring, me and my dad and Charles are working painting this house, and all of a sudden, my mom's like, I'm in Denver. Cool. Someone come get me?
Yeah. Mike, please drive 3 hours immediately.
Yeah. 2.5, if you're lucky.
Well, with the way your dad drives, yeah.
Yeah, but still, like, best case, 6.5 hours round trip, because, like, getting into the airport, parking,
yeah,
finding my mom...
But additionally, I was panicked. Like, are we venting? Is this a therapy session to you guys? No, but additionally, I was panicked because I was like, okay, I got to make sure that your dad's house looks nice for her. And then, okay, if, you know, you and I are uncomfortable sleeping on the garage pull-out bed, you know, shoot, one of us can't go to the couch in the living room because she will probably end up going there. Like, what are we going to do?
It's just a lot of people in a pretty small house.
Yeah. I don't want to brag, but
yeah, I mean, this is cool. Well, the problem is that it's more garage than it is house. This is really just a tiny one man, two man cabin,
yeah,
with a working garage. You know, that's where we live most of the time. There's only one bathroom, so really, my biggest fear is just like, you know, my mom will immediately also complain like about the difficulties.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so this is therapy on Seven Deadly Sinners right now.
Okay, but we're in the house.
Yeah, we're good. Yeah, so but we have our house that
we've got a lot of headroom. I mean, we're sitting here next to a scaffold, and all of our cabinets, which are in boxes.
Why does the scaffold matter?
Well, I'm just trying to give people the lay of the land. Like, this is...
We're really in the
midst of a construction site still.
We are looking at... And by the way, if you're looking for a wedding venue for 2026, probably 2026, late 2025, we do... It is a
Rachel
beautiful
will book
home.
You tomorrow, honestly.
Absolutely.
I'm the one
it
who's
is
like,
a beautiful
is
home
done.
And a lot of land. Whoop, whoop, whoop. No, it's going to be beautiful, and I will decorate it beautifully. It's like a 3,000 square foot home that you built
it's
by yourself.
It's more than that, actually. And it's okay. Awesome. And there, we are currently under like a 24 foot ceiling here. That's what it's all this headroom and this big, giant, grand, great room that is creating that reverb.
Okay. Well, you know who created her own life?
Tell me.
Would be the subject of our case today. So who was our tempting seductress? Marguerite Olivaire. Born in 1890 on December 9th. But at times she would also adjust her birth date to appear younger or attract younger men.
You've never done that.
No, I just lied about my height mostly.
Well, you look like you're 27, so.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. No, I never lied about my age, really. I don't think. No, I lied about my height when modeling. I still
You're
still
shrinking,
do.
Though, so.
Whatever. I lost an inch in an accident. Leave me alone. Anyways, she was from humble beginnings, but she would stretch the truth and say her dad was a law clerk and her mother was a hat maker, when in reality, her dad was basically a cab driver of sorts and her mom was a cleaning lady. But she was, from a young age, was stretching the truth.
Okay, this don't seem like that bad of, I mean, a law clerk, he's not even the lawyer over a cab driver.
I would have gone
a little bit more hardcore.
Okay, well, that's you.
Dad's a war hero.
Yeah, there you go. But they were a poor Parisian family. But because her dad was what they called, it was actually a coachman and her mom housekeeper, they worked in elite households in Paris. So she was exposed to, you know, being around fancy things in Paris. And so it made her want to be more. Like, it was like, oh, I would like to have the money that these people have, you know?
Yeah. I feel like my taste of that was when I was working for the flower shop in LA,
mm-hmm.
going to like some of the richest houses of all time. And I'm just like, gosh, I hope I make it big one day.
Yeah.
Live in a house like this.
Okay, so you understand. Yeah, it makes sense. I feel that way too. I mean, I don't know for that reason, because I didn't have that job, but like I did work for, I was an assistant to, you know, wealthy people and, you know,
yeah.
Just like, man, I'd like to, okay.
I mean, I was working in the movie business, you know, for years prior to that. And like I always, my first roommate in LA got a job at the flower shop. So it was a thing where it was like, I mean, I always knew about it, but until I worked there and started going to these houses, I feel like I didn't really have a taste for the finer things in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see some of these estates and these houses, and I was like suddenly interested in real estate, and then got into some real estate in LA. And I feel like, you know, I could see how being around that type of wealth, you just, you know, get influenced.
Yeah. It burned her passion for trying to climb the ranks, and, you know, no shame in that.
It's also good intel and research. You know, you know how to brush shoulders with the rich and famous after, you know, kind of seeing how they live. If your parents are working for them, you get a, you know.
Yeah. But we're gonna go a little dark for a second.
Okay.
So when she was a kid, essentially, she was about, I think, 15. Her parents were away working. She was supposed to be watching her four-year-old brother. And he ran out into the streets and was hit by and killed by like a carriage. And her parents went, which that's got to be so traumatic, like for her, for the family, for, you know.
The horse?
Sure.
What was it, the horse that trampled it, or was it the carriage? This is such a strange thing to even try to, like, comprehend. Stagecoach accidents are an underreported cause of death.
I believe so, yeah.
And people, I mean, like...
Happened a long time ago.
Well, I mean, there's like, multiple operators.
Multiple operators? What do you mean? No.
Well, there's the horse, and then there's the driver. The driver, the coachman of the stagecoach carriage driver.
Oh, that is weird that her dad was a coachman and a...
I mean, he could make a mistake. The horse could get startled. I feel like there could have been perhaps more... horse-drawn carriage accidents than automobile accidents per capita of, you know, per, you know, like.
See, the only reason why you can get away with saying this is because this is from the 1800s, because you're just spitballing here.
Yeah, I threw per capita in there just trying to sound smart.
I don't know.
But you know what I'm getting at. Like, obviously there's more cars now than there were then, you know what I'm saying? Like,
I do wonder how often that kind of happened, though. It does...
Judging from our horses.
Oh, God. Don't even bring Easy Boy into this.
He'd be a constant car crash. He'd just be biting off the door handles of others.
He already has tried to bite off ours and yeah, whatever.
Our horse is a menace. He will try to open the door and, I guess, just demand carrots or water or whatever he's feeling. Pretty much attention.
Mm-hmm.
He's a menace. Anyhow.
Meanwhile, I'll drive the truck into... Well, trees or at the car wash, the wall. Any of those would be.
Our truck looks really nice.
It's not that bad. It's just it's a little side swipe.
Hey, I'm function over fashion. Okay. It's got the power we need.
All right. Whatever. So what's pretty traumatic for her, I would imagine, is, and her parents were feeling trauma and... You know, you hear the stories about, like, when, parents lose a child, like, that often ends at, like, divorce or, like, whatever. But she was watching him, so it's kind of can correlate. They sent her away as punishment, basically. Okay. Yeah, so she was sent to a nun convent, St. Mary's type, nun convent,
The convent, man, I mean, that seems like a scary place to go at any time. I mean, just judging from my Catholic school, I didn't go to Catholic school, but I went to like Sunday school at a Catholic church growing up.
And it wasn't St. Mary's, sorry, it was Sisters of Mary's, but it was a strict Catholic boarding school.
Yeah,
there are reports where she was like beaten there and stuff and, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, those places can be.
My dad, as early as, you know, my dad went to Catholic school, and he called her, well, I don't want to say it, but he had a name for her, Sister, I'm not going to say her name, but she apparently was, like, related to my mom and showed up at their wedding. But yeah, she, like, slammed rulers on his hands and threw erasers at him, you know? I can only imagine how bad it was 75 years prior.
I'm sure that happens there. But there are some good parts of this. Because at that school, she actually did get a pretty good education.
Like, well, yeah, you know, I mean.
No, and she...
I didn't say they weren't teaching or nothing. I just said they were throwing erasers at you.
Yeah, but it was like, you know, with her family being poor, you know, that was a pretty good option for her. They, you know, they taught her, you know, she had a pretty good education.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Along with the fear of God.
Eventually, she left the convent, and the nuns sent her to live with a wealthy family to work maybe as a maid. Who knows? But
following in her mom's footsteps.
Yeah, but it didn't work out for long.
Why is that?
Well, she got pregnant.
Oh,
at that age.
By who? The son?
Historically, I don't know.
Oh.
There's so many different.
It was definitely the wealthy family's son.
No. Well, here's.
It was the dad.
Let me give you some info.
Okay.
But again, with historical stories, it's really hard to like nail down the facts because like.
For sure. Hey, we're not for nailing down the facts with these historical stories.
Okay. But we're trying to.
Yeah, we're giving you a little air of the possibilities.
Okay.
This is all alleged.
Yes.
Big, hardcore alleged.
I don't think it was with that family's son. I don't even know if they had a son. But.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just making stuff up, guys.
So like I said, when she was 15, the nun sent her away to live with a wealthy family, and she became pregnant during that time. And she would eventually flip-flop on the story of the child's father. Like many other things, she either exaggerated or allegedly manipulated. And I'm not trying to be hard on her. I believe she was a girl with a childhood trauma. Obviously losing her little brother and being blamed for it and then sent away, coupled with growing up poor and having ambition, I think it's possible she just developed a way to manipulate situations, a coping mechanism of sorts. So the two stories of the father, one was like a childhood sweetheart or high school sweetheart, and the other was from a wealthy family from India. And they would not allow her to marry her because she was a poor girl. So she would flip-flop on the stories. And
that should be pretty easy. I mean, was the baby Indian?
I don't know. She named her Raymond. We'll find out.
Raymond. Raymundo.
So you just got too far into the story.
Fernando.
Yeah, I don't know what she looked like. That's a great question, actually.
Rafondo.
No, but it was a family living in India. It wasn't necessarily an Indian family. It was a family living in India. Like, she would just be like...
But how was she in it? She was in India?
No, or the guy came to Paris and... The story doesn't make sense because she would throw the story around. Like, we don't know. It could have been a janitor at the convent. We don't know. There's no way to know this in history.
I understand, because she was... Telling mysteries.
Yeah. I mean, I partially support her gumption in life.
Yeah.
And like willingness to like, you know, I don't know, pull herself up from her bootstraps and...
Be a bit of a Forrest Gump.
Yeah. Well, and also she becomes extremely wealthy. I mean, this story gets... crazy to the point where it could be a two-parter. Like when I was right before we were recording, when I was researching more, this is going to involve the royal family, guys, and of England. And I once bought a book, Jesus, like the size of I'd say 5 inches tall or whatever, when I was researching Prince Andrew and Epstein.
The story's already giving me like anti-MAME vibes.
It kind of does a little bit because she is jazzy and
that's where I feel like
seductive and like
where her trajectory is going.
Yeah, it's really a story for two parts because it is fascinating. But the story of the royal family in terms of this era, again, look at the size where I'm doing my hand right now.
Yes, I see it.
How?
I'm going to say that's 3 inches.
I would say 4.
Whatever. No.
Whatever. I'm a gambling man. I'd go 4.
I've been handling up 2x4s. I can tell you. Okay, spot whatever. On. That was 3 inches.
Okay. But when I was heavily researching Epstein back in like 20, I don't know, but right before the pandemic, working with those Australian gals, I got this book because they were telling me about the royal family involved, blah, 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 blah. The history of them is so intense. I mean, the amount of murders, too, involved and...
Hey, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yes.
I don't know who said that, but it's like a famous quote.
Yeah, I know. And I'm sure you said it before. And
Wow, I definitely but
I'm really
have.
Proud. I'm really proud of you for dropping it again.
There, that was a bomb yeah, for all you guys.
You just
there.
Dropped a bomb on
Corruption
ya.
Bomb. Yep. Boom. Got your royal family.
Woo.
Pegged.
So the wealthy family she was working for, when they found out she was pregnant, they were like, you're out of here. Like, this is too much for us. It's too scandalous. Go back to your family. She was like, I can't go back to my family. They've already kicked me out. Like, I have nowhere to go. But
what'd she do?
She got busy.
As any entrepreneur would.
So such trauma might be too much for the average person, but it made her who she was. It made her tough. It made her scrappy. It made her a little manipulative. It made her angry at certain points. She figured it out. So she gave birth to her baby and named her Raymond. But because she didn't have...
It was a she.
Yes.
Raymond.
Raymond. I don't know.
Raymond? Like M-O-N-T-E?
A-R-Y-M-O-N-D. But I think you could be like, Raymond.
Okay.
Bonsoir. Bonsoir.
Sure.
That's good night. I think. Or good evening. I don't know. That was my favorite thing. I've been to Paris several times and I love when they say bonsoir.
Been to Paris. Don't even know what it means. Good night. Good evening. Bonsoir.
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 I
haven't been to Paris. I've been to France. Been to Geneva. Nope. Paris for me.
Okay.
Bonsoir. Yet. Worked with a Parisian woman.
Oh, she's lovely. No, she is.
She is, absolutely.
She did the podcast.
She did. She was on the podcast. That's right. Yeah. Valerie was on the podcast. French film director that I worked with a couple times. Great.
Yeah. If you've listened to it, you'll know.
Yeah. It was Le Mans, the episode about Le Mans.
Oh, that story was
Balaclava.
Crazy.
Balaclava.
That story was crazy. But when she had to get busy, luckily Paris at the time was, and still is, like a luring, kind of just illustrious, decadent city. So she was lured into the work of sex work, basically.
Oh. That's where you were going.
Yes. But I was also going to say that I've seen that by being there. I stayed in an area where it was like, oh, there's still like brothels and stuff like around.
You better not have gone in any of those.
No. I did go to one in Germany, though.
What? What?
For the German Alps.
There.
Not for me.
Well, yeah, I didn't think so.
Yeah, whatever. We didn't know what it was. What doesn't matter. There was nothing else to do there. Okay. Anywho, she became one of the highest class courtesans. A sex worker.
Courtesans?
Okay. Yes.
Sounds like a step up from consort.
No, I think it's just the plural of courtesan.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. We're going to keep using the word courtesan or courtesans. Or maybe sex worker. I don't want to say prostitute because normally I use sex worker in the
sex worker podcast. Sounds way worse than prostitute in my mind.
I think courtesan sounds the best.
Well,
it's
I
just
agree
like,
with you
oh,
there.
It's a courtesan.
Courtesan.
It's a courtesan. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds like some yeah. sort of Spanish princess or something.
Yeah, it's lovely. So she ends up getting picked up, not picked up, but noticed because she was really beautiful. She had like light brown hair, big brown eyes. But she had learned sort of a little bit of like her allure from the nun convent thing, but.
Got her swag from the nuns.
Well, actually, certainly not from them.
Yeah, right. They're so off limits. I bet she did get some, like, you can't have it. Courtesan.
Yeah, maybe swagger. She was just like, how not to act. anyways, so she gets picked up by a very famous, and I'm not saying they picked up like kidnapped, but
paid for.
Well,
services acquired.
Taken under her wing by a famous brothel owner.
Oh, okay.
Madame,
apprenticeship.
What?
And like an apprenticeship.
Yeah. Yes. Madame Dinard noticed her beauty, and quickly took her under her wing. And then she basically kind of schooled her in the way to act like a high-class lady. You know, say the right things, speak very little, be very slow, be very, you know, like, just...
Who trained you in the ways of a high-class lady?
No one. Because I'm not.
You are, too.
No, I'm not. But she just thought she was going to be one of her best girls.
Well,
okay.
How does
Don't talk
go?
Too much. Walk properly. Wear the best things.
Ask them about themselves.
Ask them about themselves. Speak slowly. Speak quietly. Speak kindly.
You're hypnotizing me.
She saw her as the best of her girls to become the most high-class escort of sorts. And Marguerite did. She did to a historical degree. She maybe have even have changed history at a certain point.
Whoa.
Yep. Okay.
Well, I believe that, you know, escorts, ladies of the night, whatever you want to call them, whatever the politically correct term is, had a lot of influence back in that time because it was
Absolutely.
It was a lot more accepted, you know, as a occupation and, you know, as something that occurred. It wasn't illegal.
Well, I can also tell you this, that it was, okay, when she came up and when she encountered her most influential man, it was World War I, and those men needed comfort. Like, they were looking for anything. Like, if a lady was going to be like, hi, I'd love to see you.
Yeah, it's just interesting you bring up the war, because that's like what, you know, someone recently told me that the only way prostitution would become legal again in the United States was if there was a war on sovereign soil, and I never even thought, I was like, that it'll never be legal. I don't know why this was a topic either, but... Like, interesting thought that that's like something that, you know, war,
they needed comfort. It
war
was
war create exactly what I'm saying. Like, war creates this thing where, like, the governments of the world were like, yeah, we need like our soldiers to have companionship. Prostitution's legal,
or it just is like a good breeding ground for like it's a good business model for that time.
Well, that too, I guess.
I mean, same thing with, like, around here with, like, the mining stuff, like...
Oh, that's exactly what it was. The reason we were... Because there's an old brothel. Like, a building that was a brothel that's, you know, still standing. Rotted wood and all. From the mining era. You know, about 3 miles from our house. That's why.
So in 1907, Marguerite finally fell in love with one of her, you know, people that she was a consort for.
And suitors.
What?
Suitors.
Suitors. Yeah, yeah, a suitor.
It's got to work.
André Millard, a wealthy wine merchant.
Ooh.
Yeah, he had a bunch of horses, about 40.
Wow. This sounds up your alley. Wine merchant, got horses.
Oh, you say wine. I'm all the time.
I better get into wine to keep you.
No, but I also love horses, and we have a demon of a horse, but...
But his Uncle Ace is the man, and he lives on our property, too, because they're such good pals, we can't separate them.
Yes, exactly. Anyways, he had, like, 40 horses, and he taught her to ride, and she really loved being around the horses. Unfortunately, he was already married, so... You know, it wasn't so. Yeah, so this is what we would call an affair. But he did put her up in a really fancy apartment, and you know, bought her things. She got the finest of clothes. She was, you know, going to the best restaurants.
Affairs sound expensive.
Yep. Yeah, well, yeah, of course. But they were also very accepted. In that Parisian era of that time.
Affairs were?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But regardless.
Sounds Parisian.
Yeah.
In the late Parisian. 1800s.
Exactly. They became embroiled with a passionate affair that lasted probably 6 years. Again, he was married. She was still doing her sex work, though, which
what?
He did not
well,
love.
Well, I guess, well, screw him, he's married.
Well, that's okay. Well,
I can't be, I mean, for her, I guess, if you're doing the sex work, easier to be with a married man. But for him, I can't imagine being in a six-year relationship while you're in another relationship. That's just preposterous to me.
Yeah, she still continued to do the sex work. She loved the attention of other men, allegedly, and, well, I do think she maybe loved this man, but she needed to make money, and this is all she knew. She was trained to do this, and perhaps became addicted to the attention.
Addicted to the attention.
And he didn't love that she was still doing her sex work. It made him jealous, made him feel bad. Though he was married, like we talked about. But it finally came to a head in 1913. On their parting, he gifted her 200,000 francs, which in today's money and U.S. dollars would be $6.5 million.
Not too shabby.
She was set. Then she also sent for her young daughter, who had been living on a farm, to come back to her. She now had the money to support the young daughter. She was able to afford a lavish apartment, fancy clothes, and began dining in the highest society restaurants. And eventually became the paramour of her highest conquest yet. It's World War I now, 1917. She was back to her old ways, and by way of a friend, met Prince Edward of the royal throne. Edward was born during the reign of his great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, as the eldest child of the Duke and Duchess of York. Later, King George V and Queen Mary, he was created Prince of Wales on his 16th birthday. 7 weeks after his father succeeded as king. As a young man, Edward served in the British Army during the First World War. He did several overseas tours, but he gained popularity because of his charm and charisma. The main thing related to this story, though, by 1917, Edward liked to spend time partying in Paris while he was on leave from his time on the Western Front. And he was introduced to Marguerite Albert, who he became infatuated with. He wrote her candid letters, which she kept. A little manipulative, which you'll come to find out in episode 2.
I think that's The biggest compliment you can get from someone who you write a letter is them telling you they kept it.
I think she kept it for other reasons, which will find out in the which served
it
her.
It seems to me like she might have like interfered with the war, changed history.
It has been said that it has.
I can't wait to hear more.
Yes. So.
Oh, Marguerite.
Oh, yeah. He said like that it was like the worst thing for him to have to leave her. Like the blood of the war was, you know, not as bad as like the blood of leaving her, you know, the pain. Yeah. So should we end here on this cliffhanger? Because it becomes the only reason why she survives capital murder.
What?
A capital murder trial. Sorry. She murdered someone.
Yeah, I'd say it's a pretty good cliffhanger. Seems like she might have had her hand in steering World War I, gets off on murder. I mean, these are some major plot lines that seem to probably have more time than we have right now.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I do think it deserves two parts. Not to leave you guys on a cliffhanger, but I want to dig more into the whole like royal part of this.
Yeah, the royal family in general is just like wild to research. Each one of them have their own interesting, crazy storylines.
Mm-hmm.
Especially from this era. Like, didn't they kind of like start World War I? I mean, it was a royal family. I don't know which royal family. Might not have been the British one. It's like Franz Ferdinand. You know, this is all... it's a big deal.
Okay, because this story is so fascinating and it involves the royal family and apparently what Greg was correct about...
World War I, yeah.
Franz Ferdinand?
Got started by Franz Ferdinand getting shot. Not the band, the man.
Okay. Well, next week, we're going to go into how this story gets so much crazier and how much her dalliances with wealthy men definitely saved her from capital murder.
Hey, why else would you get into those? If you can't be saved from a capital murder trial, I mean, why sleep with a judge?
Okay, you're an idiot, but you guys are not. And thank you so much for listening. I love Greg. I'm just joking. But I love you guys so much. Thank you so much for listening. And until next week, this is a story I didn't know needed so much more digging into.
I'm blown away.
Yeah, because of the whole, like, royal family part of it, and, like,
of course, a woman changed the course of World War I.
Yeah.
I would not be so...